Senate Finance, please come back to order. It's 4:42 on the afternoon of May 13th. Recognize Senator Stevens, Senator Bundy, Senator Olson, Senator Hoffman, and Senator Taylor joining us at the table tonight is Senator Wagoner for upcoming legislation. Senator Green is ill this afternoon, doing fine, back to the hotel. Expected to join us either later this afternoon or when we convene on the floor at 7 o'clock, so that's good news. Let's see, where were we? What are we going to do this afternoon? Senator Hoffman, are you going to help?
We're going to adjourn, I think.
No, we're not going to adjourn, not yet. All right, well, our business tonight is going to be Senate Bill 213, Nick Arm, Senate Bill 117, Longevity Bonus, Senate Bill 100, Capital Budget, be number 3. Number 4 will be new bill, Senate Bill 185, Royalty Reduction on Certain Oil. And 5, if we get to it, Senate Bill 202, Education Funding and Pupil Trans. Remind the members and folks in the hearing room to turn off your cell phones and pagers. Anything else come before the committee before we begin our deliberation? Seeing none, let's bring forward Senate Bill 213. Senate Bill 213 establishes an independent authority to build and operate a toll bridge over the Kinnick Arm. We had this before us before. We are in consideration of version A. And let's see, we have 4 amendments, of which they're essentially like amendments. So let's see, Tracy, where's Tracy? Oh, Tracy, you join us at the table and just help us through a couple of things here. We had some discussion the other day, remember, about the composition of the board. And Senator Green, you have distributed amendment number 4. Does the committee have amendment number 4? Okay. I would move on behalf of Senator Green amendment number 4. And I would ask Ms. Carpenter to explain amendment number 4. Earlier on, Senator Hoffman had offered amendment number 1, which is very close to 4. So, Senator Hoffman, if you'll look at the differences, I think you'll agree. So let's start with explanation amendment number 4. Tracy?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Tracy Carpenter, legislative aide to Senator Lyda Green. Amendment number 4 adds 2 additional public members to the board proposed by the governor's office, one to represent the Matanuska-Susitna Borough, one to represent the municipality of Anchorage. The 3 public members of the board shall serve staggered terms of 5 years. And the last page attached to this amendment is a provision establishing the initial terms of the public members. The other differences, the other small changes are conforming amendments, if you will, to change tense and A to the member to members, et cetera, and so forth, just to correct the language with the addition of the 2 public members. There is one other difference from Senator Hoffman's amendment number 1. At the top of page 2 of amendment number 1, lines 1 and 2, as it reads in Senator Hoffman's amendment, this is not included in our amendment.
Discussion on amendment number 4. Senator Taylor?
I just wondered why these people needed to be resident in either Mat-Su or municipality of Anchorage, because I think there's a lot of people in the southeast that would have great solutions they could offer the people.
Thank you for that reply, Tracy. And other discussion on amendment number 4. Senator Stevens?
Can we get feedback from the commissioner's office on this amendment?
Tracy, please.
Yes, sir. Actually, John McKinnon from DOT is okay. Here, and John? We worked with them on this.
John, if you join us, please.
John McKinnon, Deputy Commissioner of Transportation.
Afternoon.
Good afternoon, Senator.
In response to Senator Stevens, please.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, the administration has no problem with this amendment. very similar to what came out of House Transportation.
Other discussion on Amendment Number 4. Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is it reflected, is the amendment reflected in the fiscal year?
I'd like to defer to Mr. McKinnon.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, the amendment is not reflected in the fiscal note. The fiscal note would be need to be amended, and I believe it would probably add about another $14,000 to the fiscal note, $14,400. In other words, two more members at a stipend of $300 a day for two-day meetings once a month. That would be the extreme end of it.
Per year.
Senator Olson, I can tell you that Senator Green was working with the administration, the department at DOT. She had concerns about the fiscal note, and I know they're in negotiations to reduce that $523,000 number. So I think at the end of this process, the fiscal note will be significantly less. I don't know just how much. I know they have been in negotiation. Other discussion on Amendment Number 4? Is there objection? Seeing none, Amendment Number 4. Passes. Let's see. Other discussion. I wanted to look at Senator Green, Amendment Number 3. Tracy, do you know if we need to offer that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I believe we do.
Okay. I would, on behalf of Senator Green, offer Amendment Number 3 and object for clarification. Tracy?
This amendment deletes Section F on page 8, and I've been informed by the Department of Law that this section needs to be removed or it may impact the state's bond rating. I would like to defer to Catherine Strasburg with the Department of Law to explain further.
John, thank you. Catherine, please come forward. And we're on page 8, lines 16 through 20, Section
yes.
F, or paragraph F.
Kathleen Strasburg, Department of Law. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This particular section does what is known as creating a moral obligation on the part of the state to back the bonds of this agency, and that's not consistent with several other sections of the bill, which are designed to assure the financial independence of this body. Indirectly, it addresses something that you, Mr. Chairman, brought up on Saturday, which is a concern about whether the state's rating or finances are implicated by it. It has also been recommended to us. This problem was brought to our attention by the Treasury Division, and so we would strongly recommend that it be deleted from this. It's essentially an oversight in the sense that it was borrowed from another statute.
Thank you, Kathleen. Questions of the Department of Law? Okay, thank you. I'll remove my objection to number 3. Is there objection to number 3? Seeing none, amendment number 3 passes. Are there other amendments to Senate Bill 213? Senator Hoffman?
Can I ask a question of the Department of Law, please?
Ms. Strasburg?
At the last meeting, I had asked whether or not this authority was under the Executive Budget Act, and we didn't really get a clear answer on that.
The what is under the Executive Budget Act are those funds that come from the state, and it's required to report on the Executive Budget Act, except that the debt retirement part of it, the paying off of bonds, is off the budget. It is not covered by the act, and that is specifically set out in, if you'll just bear with me just a moment, Mr. Chairman. That would be page 5, line 9. Set subparagraph 2. Comply with the provisions of AS 3707, Executive Budget Act, except that it doesn't apply to the activities that relate to the borrowing of money. Including the issuance of obligations or evidence of borrowing. That doesn't relieve the authority from making certain reports, which are covered in a later section.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Senator Taylor?
Yeah, question, Department of Law. There was a provision, I thought, I can't seem to find it right now, that provided immunity to the authority?
Okay, yes,
I'm not finding it.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Taylor, on page 9, line 17.
I found that one as to the validity of the pledge.
Yeah, and that one relieves the board members of personal liability. Is that what you're referring to, Mr. Chairman? Mr. Senator Taylor?
I'm sorry, line what?
That was line 17. It says, neither the members of the board nor a person executing the bonds is liable personally on the bonds or is subject to personal liability or accountability by reason of issuance of the bonds.
It was line 20 you were talking about. Senator Taylor, 21.
I think I was referring to the next one.
Your question, Senator Taylor, is?
I was searching for, there was an immunity provision, I thought, slipped in the middle of one of the paragraphs that didn't seem to fit. Under the validity of pledge, all that does is provide a first claim of security on behalf of the bondholders as against the funds, and that no later claim would be exercised superior to that. At least that's how I read that, and I don't have any problem with that. I thought there was a provision.
Is it
in here.
Page 10, line 3 through 13? Is that what you're looking for?
No, it isn't. And I may have just been looking at that portion on validity of pledge and misreading it last time. I just wanted to be aware of what, if any, immunities we had provided, and I really don't have any problem with the immunity from suit against the individuals on the board for the issuance of bonds. That's a ministerial and a discretionary act that I think they have to do. Difficult for me to conceive how they could possibly do it in such a way that would subject them or the authority to personal liability. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Hoffman?
Chairman, I'd move amendment number 2 for discussion.
Amendment number 2 has been moved, and I'll object for discussion. Let's see. Senator Hoffman?
Mr. Chairman, amendment number 2. Well, First Amendment number 4 is quite identical to the one that I had proposed in amendment number 1 on Saturday, but I will not be offering that. But number 2 is primarily an amendment that would add a member of the Senate and a member of the House as non-voting members. And, you know, I think that this authority is a good one, and I think Senator Taylor said, why can't we have people from Southeast on there? You know, I think that this would give a tie-in to what happens with the authority as it proceeds on the construction of the toll and its operations, and I just believe that we would be better informed and not have a say, but be better informed as to the happenings of the authority as it proceeds. And I was wondering if there was arguments at this table against that.
Senator Bundy asked Mr. McKinnon to come forward. Senator Bundy?
Just relating a sort of parallel experience, I know in the Post-Secondary Ed Commission, they have appointees in the House and the Senate. There is an ongoing legal discussion as to whether we ought to be there because we have the powers of appropriation, I guess. But I always, having served in that position, thought that
it was an asset to that organization to be able to have someone there that could represent perhaps the thoughts or concerns of the legislature.
Speak in favor of the amendment. Mr. McKinnon, if you'd give us the administration's thoughts, amendment number two.
John McKinnon, Deputy Commissioner of Transportation. As far as the administration's thoughts go, I think that might be taken care of on page five, lines one through eight, and it requires the executive director of the board to prepare an annual report of its operations to include a balance sheet and income statement, a statement of changes in financial position, reconciliation of changes in equity accounts, summary of significant accounting principles, et cetera, et cetera. Regarding the year's business and prospects for the next year, report shall be completed by the third day of each regular session of the legislature, and the authority shall notify the governor, commissioner of the department, presiding officers of each house of the legislature that the report is available. So there is an annual reporting requirement to the legislature.
In regard to someone being on the board? Or against, neutral?
Against.
Okay. Senator Bundy?
Well, just point out that if there is legislative representation on the board, as these things are in the process of happening, they again can have access to thoughts of someone who represents the legislature rather than after the fact, and perhaps that prevents misunderstandings before they begin.
Okay. Other discussion on amendment? I'll remove my objection. Is there objection to adopting amendment number two? Seeing none, amendment number two is adopted. Are there other amendments to Senate Bill 213? Other, no amendments, no discussion? Senator Taylor?
Move the bill as amended with individual recommendations. I would object just for purposes of a comment that this may very well be the most expeditious way to get that bridge built, although it's going to be a continuing burden on those who use the bridge to support the administrative cost into the future, which wouldn't be necessary if DOT was building the bridge. But as many of you know, I've advocated for many years that we should have toll roads and toll authorities, and that the Marine Highway is a perfect example of what we ought to have, a Marine Highway Authority. Now, this administration has chosen instead to have a Marine Advisory Board, and have promised me that they would reconsider that issue and question next year after the Advisory Board has had an opportunity to work to see whether or not we should move to an authority so that we had people concerned and interested in the ferries operating them, instead of just having political appointees in that position, which change from time to time. I wish you the very best. I'd love to see that bridge built, because as far as I know, it's only the constituents of Southeast Alaska that pay a fee to ride on or drive on a state highway, the Marine Highway System. And to give you an example of what those fees are like, for me to take my pickup truck home from Juneau to Wrangell one way is over $500. So if we figure out the per miles, maybe we're looking at probably a $15 to $20 toll to go across your bridge.
And do you remove your objection? All right. Senator Bundy,
Moving
the bill?
I have an objection. You mentioned that the fiscal note is still being addressed, and as part of that process, will this seed money be added to future tolls? I think this, whatever it is, $2.5 million at this point, or whatever it is, should be part of the operating expenses of that bridge. And at this point in our general fund, I think we should watch them, even if it's only a million or two. So do you have any indication whether they'll be added? And I am not supportive until I
And by this seed money, you mean which seed money?
The fiscal note that we have here.
Whatever it comes out below 523?
Whatever it is.
Will it be added to?
The operating expenses that will be paid back by the toll.
Mr. McKinnon? So the expenses of getting it organized, Senator Bundy, would they be rolled forward so that they're paid back through the tolls? Is that the question?
Yes.
Okay. Through the chair, Senator Bundy, I would expect that they would.
For the record, they will be. I'll remove my objection.
Okay. Any other objection to moving the bill from committee as amended? Attached fiscal notes?
Do you have any idea what it's going to cost to cross the bridge? What's the toll going to be when somebody wants to cross it?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, we have no idea. At this point, the project is conceptual. We've got ballpark budget figures of what it's going to cost and what it's going to operate. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Other discussion on moving the bill? Objection? Seeing none, Senate Bill 213 passes from committee. Thank you, John, for being here. Yeah, let's bring forward Senate Bill 117, calculating the longevity bonus program. Senator Taylor?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that the committee take up work draft.
Excuse me, Senator. One discussion at a time. Okay. Senator Taylor?
Thank you. I would move that the committee take up work draft CS for Senate Bill 117, and that is draft Cook, number letter B, 513-03. In lieu of the original bill.
Version B of SB 117 has been moved as our working document. Is there objection?
I'll object for purposes of an explanation, Mr. Chairman.
For explanation, Senator Taylor?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. What this amendment or work draft, I should say CS, does is it provides for a five-year payout period during which each year the payments would go down by basically 20%, and the program would end in 2007, and that upon so ending, then the effective date provisions, as you'll note on page 3, kick in, and at that point, the longevity bonus program is removed from the statutes. It's no longer there. As further explanation, this is not a solution that I supported or wanted to find ourselves in. I believe it is a solution that is supported by the pioneers and by the ARP organization and others that have advocated for it. I'm reluctant but willing to go along and accede to their wisdom on this issue.
Senator Taylor, thank you. I should let the committee know this is hot off the press. We don't have a fiscal notice yet. Fiscal notice pending. It'll catch up with the bill tomorrow. Is there a discussion on adopting version B as our working document? Is there objection?
Mr. Chairman, I'll remove my objection. Although I will not be voting for this, I still believe that this is something that the masses of the seniors would not support if they were polled, even though there may be groups or leaders of groups that say that they support it. I don't believe that is the will of the seniors of this state, and therefore, although I remove my objection, I will not be supporting the legislation.
Is there further objection to adopting version B? Seeing none, version B is our working document. Discussion on version B. Will of the committee?
Move the bill with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note as it arrives.
Forthcoming fiscal
forthcoming.
Note.
Forthcoming, there we go.
Motion has been made to pass Senate Bill 117 for committee with individual recommendations and forthcoming fiscal note. Is there objection?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Speak to the objection, Senator Hoffman. Just did.
The same comments. I don't believe that this is the desire of the seniors of the state. I believe that many of the leaders of the two groups that were mentioned by Senator Taylor do not speak for the masses of the seniors. And if polled, I doubt if that would be the outcome. Therefore, I oppose the movement of the bill, and the those are the comments I'm sticking to, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you, Senator Huffman. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
On objection to moving the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate this opportunity. It's been certainly been short noticed. We don't have a lot of input, but the input I have had when it was explained to me and then explained to the elders in my district, they were certainly apprehensive. Obviously, part of it has to do with changes that have gone on, their mistrust for what's going on down here, but there certainly was an element, a strong element there that voiced objection to this adoption of this legislation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sir. Thanks, Senator. Call the roll, please, Mindy.
Yes.
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 No.
No.
Yes. Senate Bill 170 passes from committee. Thank you. Let's bring forward now some new legislation, Senate Bill 185, prime sponsor Senator Wagoner. And Mary, if you'll join the senator. Senate Bill 185 is sponsored by Senator Wagoner. Senate Bill 185 permits a reduction in royalty rates for oil production from submerged lands in Cook Inlet. Royalty reduction would apply to oil produced from offshore platforms and tied to a daily rate of oil production. There's a committee substitute that, in essence, embodies the governor's proposal of an exploration tax credit that was announced yesterday, and that is version Q. And I would move version Q be adopted as our working document. And is there objection to adopting version Q?
Mr. Chairman, objection.
Senator Huffman?
Objection for our explanation of the differences.
All right, and Senator Taylor, same question. Okay, let's go to Senator Wagoner. And now, in the audience is Commissioner Corbis. He'd like to participate. Mr. Dickinson is here. Let's see, Mr. Myers and Mr. Porter. So we have all sorts of folks to help us understand the technicalities. Senator Wagoner, why don't you roll your bill out, and we're addressing whether to adopt version Q. So let's get us comfortable with generally what's in Q, and then we'll roll to the details with the experts.
Yeah.
Okay, welcome, Senator Wagoner.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Identify yourself, please.
My name is Senator Wagoner, and with me is my Chief of Staff, Mary Jackson. I think probably the best way to approach this is talk about 185 the way it was and then what we added to it, and that basically comes in. So there's two components to this bill. The first part is the original Senate Bill 185, and 185 amended the statutes to provide for reduction of royalty on oil produced in certain Cook Inlet fields and platforms as they near the end of their production capacity. The intent of the legislation is to provide a monetary incentive in the form of royalty relief to maximize production from old fields and extend the longevity of Cook Inlet oil platforms. In return, there is continued employment in the area rather than loss of jobs due to the abandonment of fields. There is also more production than would otherwise be realized because the fields will have become more economical due to the reduced cost. That results in more oil production than would have originally been realized, and subsequently more unexpected royalty revenues even at the reduced rate. Encouraging production in these marginal fields will extend their life by a minimum of 18 to 24 months, and a considerable extension of employment opportunities in the Cook Inlet Basin. The second part of this bill extends tax credits for new explorations to create new jobs and revenues for the state of Alaska in the future.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Mary Jackson, and I'm staff to Senator Tom Wagoner. And if you would like, Mr. Chairman, I can do a walkthrough on the Q version with you.
If you would, please.
Thank you, sir. Section 1 is a new subsection that is added to statute, and it gives the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission the authority to go through the produce the volumes, the data information that's needed for the new sections that we're adding to the statute. Section 2 adds one of the components to the Cook Inlet fields. It identifies the rigs that will be eligible under the 1,200 barrel per day jurisdiction. Subsection B in there identifies the value, the percentages for those 1,200 barrel per day rigs. Subsection C inserts a new mid-range. We're calling it a mid-range. That's for rigs that are specific to the 975 barrels a day. And again, those rigs are identified. Subsection D is the royalty percentage for those mid-range 975. Subsection E is the rigs that are identified at a 750 per day barrel per day. And those rigs are again identified. And subsection F is the royalty percentage reduction for the rigs that are on the 750 barrel per day production. G, IDs it at the West MacArthur River field. H is the, again, the royalty production. All these are paralleled, if you see this. H references back to that specified in G. I is the, actually, new language in statute that identifies that the rigs themselves, or pardon me, the production itself is not the result of a choke back in the production, the daily production. In other words, that they can't be some sort of a mechanical device that reduces the reduction in order for them to claim the royalty. And section 3 is the new tax credits that will be extended. The entirety of section 3 is 4 pages long, and that's the whole new tax credit provisions. Mr. Chairman, there are members here in the audience that can speak certainly to the specifics of it.
Yeah, we have with us, Mr. Chairman, Dan Dickinson from the Department of Revenue, and Steve Porter from the Department of Revenue, Mark Myers, and Commissioner Corpus.
Thank you. We'll get their testimony here just shortly. And we also have on teleconference Doug Schultz has joined us for testimony on the Off-Net Network. Senator Huffman.
Mr. Chairman, the question that I have is how does this affect the fiscal note? Do we have a new fiscal note?
Yes. Senator Huffman, would that have to do with adopting version Q? Can we adopt version Q?
Yes, I will remove my objection.
Is there an objection to adopting version Q as our working document? Okay, now, Senator Huffman, your question.
The question is how does version Q differ with the previous version as it relates to the fiscal note?
To the chair, Senator Huffman, I believe that you have been handed out some new fiscal notes, and one of them is the revenue prepared the 11th, and that is specific to the new subsection 3. Excuse me, the new section 3 of the bill. That's the new tax credit section. And the other that you were handed out, it says on it draft from the DNR. This is the fiscal note that applied to the new mid-range insertion. We put in the new 975 barrels. So that draft just applied to the 975. This one is to the new section
three, the tax credits.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hoffman, I think Mr. Dickinson is also going to help us with fiscal notes. Senator Bundy?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We had some similar legislation before us, and it indicated that this tax credit would not kick in until there was actual discovery. Does that apply in this bill also?
Yeah. Senator Wagoner, then we'll ask that same question of the department.
You're talking about in Section 3 of the bill. Section 3 doesn't have as much to do with discovery as it does with exploration. And it's what we're doing with this is trying to entice companies to invest more money in Alaska and drill more wells, so the possibility and probability of both discoveries and production goes up quite substantially.
Let's have Commissioner Corbis join us and get some testimony. Senator Bundy?
Yeah, if I might. The answer is no.
Right, no.
Let's have our testimony and let the experts ring in here. Senator, if you'll stay there. Commissioner Corbis, let's start with you, if you'd like to lead off. Good evening, sir. Good evening.
My name is Bill Corbis. I'm the Commissioner of Revenue.
Welcome, Bill. Go ahead, please, your testimony.
The exploration tax credit, which is to be applied to the severance tax, is part of the governor's, one ingredient of the governor's long-range plan. At present, the Trans-Alaska pipeline is operating at 50% of capacity. We hope that this exploration tax incentive will be one way to bring it closer to full capacity. As will be explained by Mr. Dan Dickinson, who is the director of the tax division of the Department of Revenue, the current fiscal regime is at the low end of the scale as far as offering tax incentives for companies to explore for new oil in Alaska. The governor strongly urges that this legislation be adopted. That completes my comments.
Thank you, Commissioner. Questions of the Commissioner? Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you looked at the Trans-Alaska pipeline, I was wondering, does this tax credit extend also to, or does it just include only the Cook Inlet, or does it extend up to the North Slope area that is also?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, this applies all over the state.
Applies all over the state. Thank you very much.
Senator Taylor?
Yeah, thank you, Commissioner, for that. This bill had started off, you know, as just a Cook Inlet thing, and now it's had a major policy shift in this committee substitute. I wondered why we have specifically listed in Section C and then again in Section D, pages 6 and 7. In Section C, you get credit if you're of 20%, if your hole that you're drilling is located more than, I guess, 3 miles away from an existing hole. You get another 20% if your hole is 25 miles away from somebody else's hole or yours that you've drilled. And my concern was, I had a call this afternoon that indicated that a major find had actually occurred within the last month, that well was capped off, that this credit has now shown up, and that very easily through current technology, through slant drilling and other devices, every hole they punch in the ground coming back into that known existing reservoir is going to qualify. If they stay outside the 3 miles, they're going to get the 20%.
Let's ask Mr. Meyer to join us.
Can you respond to that? And how are we going to prevent that from happening?
Let's ask Mr. Meyer to join us. Commissioner, is that all right? Mr. Meyer, if you could join us and help us a little bit with downhole expertise? Identify yourself, if you would, please. And did you hear Senator Taylor's question?
For the record, Mr. Chairman, I'm Mark Myers, Director of the Division of Oil and Gas and DNR. Senator Taylor, through the chair, the bill has some additional restrictions on it. If it's within an existing unit,
I noticed
it doesn't. It doesn't qualify. So it would have to be exploration outside of units. Also, wells that are already planned as commitment wells to plans of development or exploration would not qualify. The 3 miles from the bottom hole location is thought to be a reasonable distance that you're more than likely drilling a distinctly separate accumulation. Now, there are some cases where it's possible that you could be drilling delineation of a very large accumulation at the three mile distance. So I guess it's unlikely that delineations within existing plan for development would qualify, because most of those, all the cases I know, are currently within existing unit structure, within oil and gas units. It is possible someone could have a discovery. Again, I don't personally know of any capped off major discoveries that aren't either within units or within proposed units at this time.
No, the reason I'm asking is that's what this caller alleged. I hadn't heard anything about it either, but then I got to thinking, well, what if such a scenario does exist and it's a major reservoir? What would prevent somebody from doing exactly that? Just capping her off, making sure that we get a nice big tax incentive, and then coming back in and drilling in from around that hole and staying outside of 3 miles. Only thing we're going to know is when they come in and ask for the tax credit. And they never will uncap that other one, because why do that and blow all your tax credit? Because these are significant tax credits. These are not insignificant. I just wondered if that was possible and what you might suggest in the legislation that we do to make certain that we're not, in essence, being taken advantage of.
Senator Taylor, to the chair, I think, again, there are cases where potentially this year's exploration, particularly the NPRA wells, which we don't have the data on, if there was a large discovery there, say at Pouviac, it is possible then that if it's of substantial size that they could come in greater than 3 miles away and qualify for the credit, again, if they're beyond the three-mile limit. I guess one could argue that acceleration of the delineation wells would also lead to future. But again, to get away from that intent, you'd either have to increase the distance or have language in there about distinctly separate exploration target or such. There is language you could craft, but it would make it more complex and require more adjudication.
I just had one other question for the commissioner. I think I have some sensitivity for the position that the oil industry is alleging about high costs in Alaska and so on, and have supported and assisted in every way I could to reduce those costs over the years. But I find myself today in a very unique position. The preceding piece of legislation, we just basically cut off the funding for a senior program that was costing us $47 million a year. We're also imposing all kinds of taxes and fee increases, even contemplating a 3% statewide sales tax on the citizens who live in Alaska. And yet, I think this is the third or fourth tax credit or incentive program. We're cutting taxes to the industry at the same time that we're dramatically increasing taxes on the citizenry. And I don't know if it's just me sensing this or if the administration has some comment on that. It seems as though we're going in two totally different directions with two different sources of revenue.
Commissioner?
Through the chair, Senator Taylor, first of all, so it's clear that this will not apply until fiscal year 05 as far as the potential impact and revenues. I thought a lot about the question that you raised, And all I can say is that oil is our future, and we simply got, I consider this to be an investment, and we simply must offer these incentive, offer these, if you will, investments if we're going to have a long-term stream of oil. And that would be my response.
Thank you.
Senator Stevens?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess this must be for Commissioner Corbis. On page 8, section G, I guess a production tax credit certificate that may be transferred and conveyed. Can you explain that? Process. So an explorer could drill a dry hole and then transfer the sell the loss certificate to another corporation or entity?
Credit. To the chair. Somewhere along the line, we need to make the switch and get Mr. Dickinson up here.
Yeah,
let me answer this one. But I think, yes, he can sell it to somebody that has one of these certificates, can sell it to somebody that has a severance tax obligation within the state of Alaska, and that will can be used to satisfy an obligation of another company.
Is there any limitation on the amount that a single taxpayer could accumulate in their tax credit liability, a tax credit? It sounds to me like you can almost build up a credit in your tax credits. Is there any limitation on the amount that one company could buy from another then?
Commissioner, let's get Dan Dickinson in here because this is his area of expertise. Dan, if you'd just, you can stay there if you like. We'll pull one more chair around. Mr. Meyer, stay there, please. Pull the chair around there. Assume the wing position. Oh, you're going to, all right. No, go right ahead. That's fine. Okay. Good evening, Dan. Give us some help.
For the record, my name is Dan Dickinson. I'm director of the Tax Division in the Department of Revenue. Senator Stevens, through the chair. The purpose of that clause is to allow explorers, for example, to come in and shoot seismic on spec. And they don't have it because they don't have any production. They won't have any production.
Yeah, I understand the mechanism. I'm just wondering if there's is there a cap? Is there a ceiling? Or is it unlimited the amount that a taxpayer could buy credit?
A taxpayer.
In other words, you understand what I'm saying. So if I have a $10 million tax liability, and in a certain season, maybe there's 15 wells that are drilled and only two strike, so you got 13 credits up for sale, and you only have essentially two big buyers for tax liabilities in the state, severance tax liability. What do we know? Is there, can it be transferred for anything but that what is written on the tax credit liability?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, the amount that you could take, that the purchaser could take as a liability or could take against their tax liability would be the face value of the certificate. Typically, because this does happen in other parts of the world.
Face value or the discount value?
Face value.
Is there any limitation on the discount value?
There is not, sir. But typically, the difference will be if there were no discount allowed, then there would be no reason for a purchaser to purchase that. In other words, the purchaser still has to put the money out of pocket to acquire that certificate. For example, if I'm an explorer and I go out and I shoot $5 million worth of seismic, I will try to sell that to other producers. That's the way folks, that's the way that business works. It's called shooting seismic on spec. I now try to sell that tax credit. I've we've audited, we've determined, yes, $5 million worth of work was done. Let's assume for a minute that I sell that to a large taxpayer, let's just say BP. If I demand $5 million from BP for that tax credit, they're going to say, why bother? So they're typically going to pay me, let's say, but the amount of the credit that can be taken will be the full five. So in other words, that producer will get the credit for the face value of the certificate. And to answer the second part of your question, through the chair, there is no limit on the amount that you could acquire. I would suggest that if, in fact, we got anywhere near a limit, the program would be very successful. Typically, the three large taxpayers are writing us monthly checks in the $20 to $30 million range. And if we were starting to get credits that accumulated to that level, we'd have a very, very vibrant...
Chance of success would be good, you mean?
It would be very good. It would be very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Senator Taylor?
Yeah.
And before you start, Senator Taylor, yesterday I picked up some information here. It's sort of random, but I would refer you to two pages. This chart here, I think you saw yesterday, shows the goal upon which this legislation is based. And the other is, in a different format, is this chart here. It shows expectations of perhaps what this effort might be. But that just is, there's some other things in there just for your information. Okay, Senator Taylor.
Yeah, on the same subject, it sounds to me as though if a person is in the business of doing seismic on spec, as you indicated, they're going to go out and shoot the seismic for somebody. They have a market intended, BP or whoever. They then shoot their seismic. They then sell that seismic information, don't they? Isn't that their primary income that they're receiving off of it?
Through the chair, that's correct.
So they now they get reimbursed for the cost of doing their seismic. Then they get a tax credit back from the state, which they then discount whatever the market will bear, and they sell that to probably the same company, who then turns around and can use it as against any tax liability they have to the state on severance, right? So the state actually pays them back $100 of tax credit on what may have been $60 they paid for it, plus they got their seismic besides. So it offsets the cost to them significantly of what the seismic contract is. And the contractor comes out a little better off, too, because he not only got paid for the work, but he got paid for the discount, the price that he got for the other. And my question was similar to what Senator Stevens asked, and that is, it says on line 18, for the full amount of the credit, page 8, paragraph H. And so this certificate is the full amount of his cost in doing seismic. Now, is that a dollar number, or is it a percentage of production number?
Senator Taylor, through the chair, two observations. The first one on your model, I think clearly the price that seismic information is sold is a negotiated figure. And so if a party were, the folks buying, purchasing this will be fully aware of the tax credit that will enter into the negotiation. I would find it highly unlikely that a BP, if you will purchase both the information and the tax credit for 110% of what it cost. It's a small market. There aren't many people purchasing, but everyone will be aware of this tax credit, and that will affect the price.
Sure. I just made it two steps. It would actually be one agreement. They'd work it out up front.
Senator Taylor, through the chair, it could be one, it could be two. Typically, that information is sold to one or two parties, so it could be. One other point before I answer your second question, even though we've talked about folks shooting on spec, this might also apply to independents who don't yet have production. So that's a whole other category. Let's not focus in on just the one use of it. Sorry, Senator Taylor, I forgot your second part of your question.
I was trying to figure out, just as Senator Stevens had asked, is there some limitation on the credit itself, and is that limitation the total cost that the guy doing seismic, the hypothetical we've been using, the total cost he incurred, or is it somehow fixed on a percent of some production figure, which would allow you to buy credits and then use them as against production in some other place at even a better value?
Senator Taylor, through the chair, no. It would be the actual amount incurred, and the only limit, as the bill is now written, is in any given month, if you did acquire a bunch of certificates, as Senator Stevens suggested, you would be limited by your liability in that month. But it could be carried forward if you wanted to till future months.
That's what I mean. There's no end to these things. There's no statute of limitations on when you have to turn them in or take advantage of them.
Senator Taylor, through the chair, there is not. There is a statute. This is just a four-year window in which the work can occur. Okay. But, you know, there'd be a period after which there might be an audit, or a taxpayer may wish to hold on to them and wait until they had production and use the certificates themselves rather than sell them at a discount.
But is this sunset or something happened to it in 4 years?
Senator Taylor, through the chair, if I can, and I might just take a minute to take a little length on this, because this has proved confusing to some folks. If we look on page 8 at item A, what this establishes is, in line 27, that this applies to oil and gas produced on and after July 1st, 2004. What that effectively says is you can't take this credit. Did I say that wrong? Page 5, line 27?
Yeah.
Okay. What that says is you cannot take this credit until fiscal year 2005. In other words, that's when it'll first show up as something you can deduct on your monthly taxes. We turn the page to page 6, lines 5 and 6. It says the cost that you can deduct can be accrued or incurred between July 1st, 2003, which is roughly 6 weeks from now, and then a period 4 years later. So there's a four-year window for this work to be done. The notion here, I think the governor's notion, is we want to get this work performed. We're setting this out to say, okay, if you get it done in the next 4 years, we'll underwrite 40% of it, or up to 40% of it.
Senator Stevens, before you ask your question, Senator Wagner, why don't you come back and join us here and let Mr. Porter take your seat there so he comes to the table. We may want to ask him a couple of questions. Senator Stevens, then we're going to go to Doug Schultz on the Off-Net Network. Senator Stevens?
This actually question is just an observation. On page 6, line 14, we're actually starting on line 12. So this is for oil or gas, and is applied to a dry hole as well as a success. So this is an exploration tax credit, which is different than 61, which is only a gas well that kicks in for success. Is that correct?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, yes. Now, I actually had some remarks prepared, and I was going to compare what happened with 61 and this. There, in fact, might be some overlap, but they really do look at very different situations.
And then I guess my comment was, is the definition of essentially what expenditures would be available to be applied to the credit. 61, in my interpretation, Mr. Chairman, are a lot more expansive. Is there a reason why 61 had so much more definition, or is this one? You only have one paragraph. I don't know, Mr. Myers, I don't know who wrote 61, but I don't even know if we have it.
I've got it. Senator, through the chair, one of the differences is that 61 applies to development and exploration. And so if you look at most of the verbiage in 61, it talks about acquiring various assets and when they were placed in service.
Roads and
exactly,
you know, leasing permits and
correct,
and helicopter pads and all kinds of stuff. So I guess my question is, it just seems that was more expensive in terms of incorporating all the costs of exploration. This seems good services and rentals for surface prep, drilling, casing, and logging of the exploration well. That must be good enough definition, Mr. Myers.
Senator Stevens to the chair, I think the programs are focused at very, very different issues. The 61 it has to be a success leg. In other words, you go out and drill a dry hole, there's no credit unless another well in that field is successful, then you can deduct the dry hole credits as well. So it's focused on getting production online, and specific to gas, specifically to south of the Brooks Range. So it has a lot more limitations, but it's sort of looking at a different element of risk. It's that more at the delineation development element of risk and not the exploration risk. This the philosophy, I think, with exploration credits here are, first of all, you have a distance from infrastructure, so it's a wildcat type approach, brand new exploration. It recognizes the larger level of uncertainty that exists in the initial stages of exploration. And it bets that if you have a successful discovery, someone else will pay for the testing and delineation. So I think we limited the expenses deliberately on the exploration side, not to include testing or development costs, in most cases, delineation costs, to try to minimize the fiscal impact, yet encourage the exploration. Generally, as an explorationist, if you're on the success leg, you've done that first stage, drilled the well, logged it, have very positive results, you're gonna test that well if all capable. So the state doesn't need to contribute to that part of the operation. They will do that. You will do it as a responsible explorationist. So again, the concept here is this is more remote, more risky on the exploration, but also truly the prizes are bigger. If you look at the North Slope and the other areas, that as you move away from infrastructure, you need to find a substantial discovery or a series of discoveries to make it economic. And this is to help push that limit to get that initial capital, get the geologic information needed, and then with the belief that the companies themselves will fund a solid project if they find successful a series of exploration wells. I don't know if that answers your question.
Oh, that's good. That was. Thank you very much. That defines the reason for the narrow definition of expense.
And Senator Stevens, if I could just, through the chair, add one observation. I think this is a philosophical difference. 61 has a broad base, but a 10% credit. 159, 158 has a narrower base, but a larger credit. You may end up somehow trading off, coming out to the same dollars, but it's easier, it's more focused, it's easier to focus on as an audit.
Senator Hoffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Commissioner, I was wondering, for the, we have a 20% credit and then an additional 20% for a total of 40% credit. Is there a specific timeline, or you have this written into law for the duration? And if so, why are we expanding it to have up to a 40% credit for a lifetime under exploration?
The Chair, Senator Hoffman.
Two four years?
It's a test program. I mean, we're in a test program. We're going to see how it goes. And after 4 years, we will reevaluate.
6.51.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Two things at once. Pardon me. Who's next? I'm sorry. All right, thanks. Senator Taylor.
Yeah. Do you really believe that this will encourage independents and wildcatters?
Senator Taylor, through the chair, I believe what this will do will let us know if there are other things, other reasons that folks aren't looking at this. Do I believe it'll encourage them to look at it? Yes, I do. One of the things that I was going to hand out during my presentation, it may be worth handing out here, is to compare how much support folks would get from a government from drilling in various places around the world. And the point is, in Alaska, we're at the very bottom. You get support from the federal government. And maybe I should pass this out. I'm going to talk about it.
I think we've got it.
Do you have this table?
It was in my packet. I saw
lots of exploration.
Right. So the point, will that encourage folks to come here? Yes, we believe it will.
I had been told that part of the difficulty on encouraging independents to come into the state was the inability to access the pipe with their product, and that they might find a wonderful find, whether it's natural gas or oil, and basically end up having to give it away to BP because they can't get into the pipe.
Senator Taylor, through the chair, you need to have something to put in there first. That's clearly one of several aspects. What this is focused on is that first one, the finding leg.
Senator Taylor, through the chair, having worked on a lot of exploration projects, there's, I think, multiple ways a credit like this would work. The first place is a company that is not exploring but still has exploration acreage would try to farm out an interest in their properties, in which case this credit would be of a lot of value, bringing other partners in. You could probably, they'd probably end up sharing the value of the credit, and other companies would come in for a smaller share, disproportional. They usually typically pay a larger percentage of the cost to get a smaller percentage of the interest. So the company that has the land and has the pre-existing seismic will come in and market their prospect. It will help them to market it to other investors if the drilling costs are lowered. This credit will lower the drilling costs. So that's one way where it'll help existing leaseholders who have developed prospects. The second way it will help is we have a lot of independents on the North Slope, smaller ones like Alaska Venture Capital Group, Windstar, et cetera, that are always searching for capital for that last 20 or 30% for the projects. And we've had some very close to development, but it's been that last percentage of the project that they have not been able to fund. So there's a place where the independents, typically the majors aren't overall cash constrained. They're cash limited by based on their opportunities and selling it to their upper management. Independents, I think, will go out there more aggressively, but they are literally cash constrained. They need to see an immediate immediate return. Certainly the other issues, the access issues, the cost of getting cost of transport of crude from the North Slope are issues. The availability of rigs are issues, the availability of ice making equipment, getting through the environmental permitting process. All those are real issues for them, but they still also have a cost constraint issue. And if they can shave 30, 40% of the cost off, 20 to 40% off the cost of the well, that is important to the independents as well.
But they have to do that. When you said the word partnering, I think you actually require in here an ownership interest, don't you, before you can take that credit?
Senator Taylor, through the chair, we do not. That was one of the specifics where this would differ, say, for example, the earlier exploration incentive credit. Typically, you would expect the owners to be there. The folks shooting seismic may not, but if they have an overriding royalty interest or some other interest in there that's not a clear working interest, they would qualify for this credit.
I think that's what I meant. I thought I saw something in here that said, yes, you could be an independent seismic guy shooting it on spec, but to get the credit, you actually had to have something for which you were liable. And you had to have more than just that. You had to have an actual interest in, an ownership in that well.
Senator Taylor, through the chair, to take the credit, because it's the severance tax, yes, you have to have that interest. And that's why if an independent earns it, they then have to sell it to someone who can actually take it. The point is, unlike a program that waits until you actually have the liability, you can, as Mark said, you could get for it immediately. It might be 2 or 3 years until the independent actually had the tax liability.
But as Senator Stevens pointed out, that's a pretty small market of people that actually have that liability, so that the discount's probably going to get pretty stiff.
Senator Taylor, to the chair, we have some experience with that. We have a EIC credit, economic incentive credit on leases, which we've done about $54 million historically. Those credits have actually traded fairly well. They didn't seem to be a problem. Now, you're not getting 100 cents on the dollar, but you may get 90 some cents on the dollar. Again, it has real value, so it's a discounted value, but it's not discounted nearly as much as you might think. It seems to be a good market for it.
Thank you.
Let's go to off-net. Mr. Schultz has been patiently standing by. Mr. Schultz, welcome to Finance. Would you like to provide some testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Schultz, get a little closer to that microphone, please. I'm Vice President of Operations for XTO Energy, and I oversee the Alaska operations.
Sir, could I interrupt you just for a second,
sure,
please? We can barely hear you. If you'd get just a little bit closer.
Okay.
And if you would start over, please.
Okay. Yes, Mr. My name is Doug Schultz, and I'm the Vice President of Operations for XTO Energy, and I oversee the Alaska operations. Primarily, I am online to field any questions that there might be. Actually, I believe it's Section 2, Part C on the mid-range, just discussion, which has been very little discussion on. So I'm available for any questions there might be on that portion of this bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Schultz. Any questions of Mr. Schultz in regard to the mid-range section of the bill? Also, thank you, sir, for joining us, and of course, feel free to stay online with us. It says here, Division of Oil and Gas. Is there someone on the teleconference line that from Division of Oil and Gas? Okay, so, okay, we're back to the table. Senator Hoffman?
Mr. Chairman, in 81, we had a schedule that was referred to several times on the developmental costs and the credits and ad valorem tax and all of those, so we had a pretty good snapshot. And do we have a schedule like that for this particular program? Because I think that would be helpful, at least to me.
I think you meant 61.
61.
Mr. Dickinson? And you might speak to the fiscal note forthcoming also.
Right. Senator Hoffman, through the chair, and I believe the fiscal note has been distributed. We do not have a table. We could certainly generate some of them. We've been playing with some of them. And I think one of the ways to conceptualize this is if you find, for example, another Alpine, there would be, roughly speaking, $1 billion of revenue to flow through to the state. If you do some distributions and some expected successes, one of the things that we are consistently finding is that this has a very high rate of return to the state, considered as an investment. In other words, if you don't consider the fact that it's the state's least oil, but you just say, how much is the state going to put out for this this incentive versus how much it's likely to get back, those do have a high rate of return. The problem, of course, is that what you're hoping to do is find another Alpine, to find another something that can generate a lot of revenues. You may find that same amount of oil, but you may find distributed in lots of smaller pools, which will not have nearly as high a rate of return. So part of the problem is when you're looking at exploration success, I think MMS uses a general rule of thumb that for every dollar you spend, you find a barrel of oil. But the problem is you can't go out and spend $1 and expect to find a barrel. It's if you spend half a billion, you're likely to find half a billion. So what we're trying to do is increase the percentage, increase the chances of getting the return. But if you would like, sir, I can put together some of those spreadsheets and make them as part of the record when this bill is next heard.
Thank you.
And looking at the chart on cost of exploration, am I correct in that if you take this figure and say that you have a 60% or 40% credit and you multiply it times the 60 cents here or whatever this is, then you come up with 39. So with this credit, if it was fully implemented, we would be in the middle of the pack right below Indonesia at 39.
Senator Huffman, through the chair, that's right. This credit will bring us, will make us just average in terms of how we incentivize
this. Then more expensive places would be the Gulf of Mexico at 65, which is the same as Alaska. And then you have the United Kingdom at 60 cents. But Canada is still at 35, so we'd be still 4 cents higher than them. So that would be a pretty good reference then.
Senator Huffman, through the chair, yes, that would be a good reference. Again, on these are based on theoretical rates, so probably trying to nail a 2 and a 3 cent difference may be a little problematic. But as a general rule, I think you've identified correctly where we sit on this table.
But then for Alaska, would you say that potential fines would have the sentence behind it as well as when we went down to 39 cents would be less depending on the level of production? Would you use that language?
Senator Huffman, through the chair, I think what that means is that the amount of the credit expense that comes in is dependent on what you actually produce from it.
Right. I understand that. Right. And if we were at 39 cents, would you have that same language there? Because I assume that these are areas that have higher potential of discovery.
Senator Huffman, through the chair, and maybe I'll defer to Mark here. I think the geology may be, in the final analysis, the geology is going to what's going to matter. If people don't have a hope of finding anything, even if you're paying 95 cents on the dollar, it's not going to happen. Vice versa, why was Prudhoe Bay or some of the other places discovered without an incentive? It's because folks believe that there was a capability of finding something of that size.
Well, then, my question, I guess, in looking at this, since it was passed out, why do you have the language behind Russia, China, and Thailand, some less depending on levels of production, much less? Why is that language added here? And wouldn't that apply to Alaska?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair. I think what the this is a chart that's taken from some work by Dr. Pedro Van Meurs, and what he was trying to identify was that within some of these countries, there isn't a single rule for everything. For example, in Kazakhstan, everything is done under production sharing agreements, and so some might be higher, some might be lower. I believe the three or two of them, he says, less depending on the level of production, and then one much less depending on the level of production. He's just identifying that your ability to take the credit ties back to how much you actually produce.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question that I can think I could tie into one. It may take me a minute to explain it all.
The clock is ticking. Go ahead.
I got you. And it ties in on section on page 6, number 4, lines 23 through 25. It has to do with a plan of exploration or a plan of development for any unit in the state at the time of the expenses incurred. And then maybe the first part of the question is for those of us that aren't experts in the delineation of a unit in exploration terms, could you define that for me? And then second is, on page 7, lines 12 through 15, then it says, however, the amount of the expenditure that is otherwise eligible under this section is reduced proportionally for the portion of the seismic exploration activity that crossed into a production unit or an exploration unit. And then sort of an overriding question is, does this credit apply to the expenses associated with the purchase of the lease sale that establishes a new unit?
Right. Senator Stevens, through the chair, I'm going to let Mark answer most of that question, but I'll answer the piece that I do know the answer to, and that is the last one. No, it would not. Lease acquisition costs would not be included in this.
Yeah, Senator Stevens, the chair. I think first and foremost, this credit is designed to stimulate activity that wouldn't occur otherwise. So when we form a unit, and a unit's an aggregate of leases put together for common exploration or development. Early stages, you can form and what a unit does is the state reaches agreement with lessees. Lessees have an operator typically. The operator agrees, the state agrees, if we extend these leases beyond a certain time, beyond their primary term, we will get certain activities performed. We look at the underlying geology. We look at what's a reasonable plan of exploration. We require well commitments. So we say you must, in order to keep this acreage longer than its primary term, the state is harmed unless exploration occurs in an orderly fashion. If it's going to sit on the acreage, we'll take it back and release it. So as a condition to extend those leases in the exploration sense, we require wells to be drilled. And the number of wells that are determined by the size of the unit, the prospectivity of the unit, whether it's one or two oil prospects or gas prospects, it depends on the data. It can commonly incur a commitment to require to shoot seismic as well. So again, we work with the operators. A typical unit term might be 3 to 5 years, and it has its orderly plan of development. We don't think it's appropriate under those conditions to pay an exploration credit for work they have to commit in order to keep the acreage anyway. That's just not efficient, and it's not. I don't think it's in the state's best interest. So fundamentally, again, additional work, exploration can occur on the leases in their primary term. There's no problem with that occurring. And in fact, that's really what you want to stimulate, is to get out there drilling earlier rather than wait till a 7-year lease is in its sixth or seventh year to shoot the seismic and extend into exploration. So again, that's the purposes of the unit. Now, units exist kind of in two flavors, even though there's only one unit. Units that are in their phases of exploration, in which case you haven't discovered commercial hydrocarbons, you're still exploring to determine whether you have them. And once you cross that critical threshold, if you're successful, then it goes into a plan of development, which leads to orderly creation of facilities, pipelines, drilling numerous development wells. So again, the intent was, once you have a unit and you have production, or you have the surety of production, your exploration risk in the surrounding area, your cost structure is very different than it is if you're drilling out away further from infrastructure, where if you discover something, you have to create that infrastructure. So you'll see here then certain types of activities within the unit, the credit's not allowed, and that's the reason. As for seismic surveys, often there's relevant units for shooting them in units, and certainly units capture the geology at a point in time. But as you get more information, there well could be prospectivity outside that unit boundary. So a company may want to shoot seismic outside and inside simultaneously along the same survey. They'll design on a survey. What we're saying here is we'll cookie cutter out the stuff that's required or within the unit and give you credit only in that outside the unit. It doesn't make sense to shoot separate surveys. So it's just an apportionment, again, trying to just determine the exploration risk associated with this and stimulation of seismic that wouldn't otherwise be shot.
Mr. Stevens, would you repeat that back to us?
No. What he's telling us is it doesn't have to be in a unit in order to apply the tax credit.
Thank you.
So one follow-up. So essentially, this could essentially form new units for production. The result of bringing in the seismic portion of what's applied to the tax credit.
Senator Stevenson. Okay. Basically, the natural evolution is after you discover something to form the unit for development, because you've got to hold those leases beyond their primary term. You know, reasonable exploration development stage is 30 years or so for a field, 20 or 30 years of the life of the field. The at least term is only 7 to 10 years, depending on where the leases are. So in order to extend those leases, you have two choices. One is to produce each individually separately, and they're held by a producing well on the lease. That's inefficient, most, again, particularly on the North Slope, where a field has to be substantially larger typically than a single lease. So you produce the formation in commonality, so you need a unit. You need an economic unit that reflects the underlying geology, which is typically much bigger than a lease. So inherently, you go to a production type that's contains multiple leases that have to be held production and produced in common, and it's most efficient to do it with a single operator. The unit agreement ties all that together and makes that work. So again, that's why we do units. It's very rare in Alaska. It does happen, but it's very rare, and I don't know of any cases in the North Slope where there's any extended production that's not within a unit. So again, once it's within a unit, that unit then is a production that has facilities, in a development unit, it has a pipeline. It doesn't need the incentive the same way someone else does exploring out away from that unit. So again, that's why the unit activities are excluded.
Thank you, Mark. Did that answer?
Got it, yeah.
That is okay.
I call it a unit exploration credit instead of an oil exploration credit. We'll call it a unit exploration credit.
All right. Well, thank you for that clarification.
Senator
Taylor.
Yeah, just briefly, in the fiscal note from the Department of Revenue on royalty reduction and production tax credit, and I'm assuming that's to this bill, in the explanation, the indication is that if we're successful in doubling the amount of exploration that is going on, that next year it will cost the state of Alaska $100 million in revenue.
Senator Taylor, through the chair, that would be a ceiling based on some of these estimates. The more we look at it, and depending on exactly how some of the definitions are parsed, that could be a little high, but it is that order of magnitude. I wouldn't want to mislead you that trying to make a substantive difference in exploration costs is a cheap proposition.
You know, all I'm concerned about is we frequently talk at this table, especially this time of year, of meeting an arbitrary number that's just been kind of grabbed out of the air, I think, of about $400 million draw on the Constitutional Budget Reserve in light of current revenues. And we've been working for months to try and find ways to generate additional revenues and to reduce the expenses of government. A $100 million increase right now in revenue would be very much appreciated around this table. But to reduce our revenues for next year by $100 million, and then it's followed by this statement, there likely would be minimal new revenues to offset the revenue loss, with significant new production likely to start flowing after the credit has expired. That's 2007 or 2011. I'm not sure how far it is, seven. So we're not going to see any new revenues coming in off of this for 4 years of any significance. That's your belief, I guess, or the revenue department. And we're going to invest, as you say, what probably is over $400 million in that effort. I sure hope you boys are right, because the people are going to pay one hell of a price for having $100 million less revenue next year and the year after that. I mean, this is not a little concept. This is major. And if it takes us a couple days to figure this one out, we ought to be taking it, because I don't know where you're going to get the other $100 million revenue.
Senator Taylor, you're exactly right, and that's why we're spending this time on this tonight, having the people help us walk through it. It is big legislation. And Mr. Porter, you had something to respond to Senator Taylor? Or
Senator Taylor, through the chair, it might be helpful.
Identify yourself, please, Steve.
Steve Porter, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue. It might be helpful to understand how you come up with a $100 million price tag, in just terms of looking at the analysis. To get there, you've really got to drill most of those wells outside that 25-mile area to get to that. If we could get enough exploration companies up here to do that, the amount of, statistically, the amount of drilling it would take would be substantial. So that is, for me to say, it's an optimistic amount. What we want to do is we want to be very conservative with this to show you the high numbers. It is our expectation we probably would not get there, but we definitely wanted to show you the numbers that were in the range of possible. Most of, if you compared this year, for example, most of the wells that were drilled were actually, I think there was maybe one well that would have been outside that 25-mile zone, and all the rest would have been between 3 and 25, so you would have seen a substantial reduction. So our expectation is not that we'll hit the $100 million, but that would be the outside that we would expect to see from this bill.
We've been joined by Mr. Tabler on off-net site. Mr. Tabler, would you like to provide testimony on Senate Bill, or House Bill 185? Senate Bill 185.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. My name is Kevin Tabler. I'm the Land and Government Affairs Manager for UNICAL. And just wanted to briefly make a couple of comments. We've been following this piece of legislation as it's progressed through the House and the Senate. And I'm listening to the discussion. We don't want to lose the importance of the primary purpose of the bill, which was for the royalty reduction aspect of it in the Cook Inlet. And although we believe that the committee substitute would be a wonderful thing to have, I just want to make sure that we don't lose sight of that. One issue or one concern that one area of clarification I think that would be helpful. Most of the discussion that I've heard has basically centered around thinking about exploration on the North Slope. And I think it's important that we think about exploration statewide. There's one area of the amendment that I had seen, and I apologize, I don't have the most current amendment, but what I do have is, I believe it's under C2, and I apologize, I don't know what page that is, but it refers to the 20% production credit, and what what that expenditure must apply to and what the qualifications are. And I want to just talk just briefly about that one section, because it says it would be for an exploration well that is located and drilled in such a manner that neither the borehole nor any part of the borehole is at any time located less than 3 miles away from any part of a borehole of a pre-existing oil and gas well. I think if we just clarified that, I know what the intent was, but I believe that the concern I have is in the Cook Inlet. If you drew a 3 mile arc around every well that had been drilled, every borehole, you would have no place to drill a well. There have been hundreds of wells drilled on the Kenai Peninsula. And if you have to be 3 miles away from any borehole, then you've lost the incentive for this. One other concern that I have is
Mr. Gaber, before you move on, I just want to make sure the committee's dialed into the right page. Page 6, I believe he is on line 26, is that right?
It's not line 26 on my draft, but...
Okay, well, your draft may be differently, but
it's
paragraph C. Just want to make sure that Mr. Myers and the department is looking at the right section of the bill. So, everybody got that in front of them? Mark, got that in front of you?
Yes, okay. Yes, I do.
Go ahead, please, Mr. Tabler.
Yes, thank you. The other issue about that is not only the density of the wells that are drilled on the peninsula, but you could have a depth component to this too. And not to complicate or confuse the issue, but what you know we've all heard about the 12 TCF of gas that may be located in the Cook Inlet announced by Escapeda. Well, if they wanted to drill, let's say some company wanted to come in and drill a 19,000-foot test down or 15,000 to test the Jurassic, and they wanted to do it from an existing platform, well, they would be less than 3 miles away from an existing wellbore, and clearly that's a totally different formation. So I guess with those two components in mind, and I'm not very artful in the way of drafting, but I believe if we said something to the effect of where the line, my draft, says 3 miles away from any part of a borehole of A, I think if we inserted AOGCC certified and struck pre-existing and then went on to continue with oil or gas well and then inserted the language producing from a formation or certified capable of producing from the same formation in the exploration well. And maybe that could be drafted differently, but I think Mr. Myers will understand my concern there. But I'll conclude my comments with that in saying that I don't want us to lose sight of the royalty component of this bill, and I'll conclude my comments there.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Tabler. Mr. Meyer, response?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think truly you have to focus in on what you're trying to incentivize. There's obviously exploration for deeper horizons in existing fields. There's exploration adjoining to it, step-out wells that test different fault blocks of the basically extensions of the same field. And then there's true wildcat exploration that's farther from infrastructure, has more uncertainty, and farther from other known mapped accumulations. All of it can qualify as exploration. There's no doubt about it. All of it has a place. The question is really what you want to incentivize. The 3 mile limit, I think, was set out to say this is really for extreme wildcat. Certainly, as you go down in Cook Inlet, testing some of the deeper horizons that have had minimal tests in them has a lot of risk and a lot of expense to it. And it may be underlying a known or producing gas reservoir or oil reservoir. That's absolutely exploration. The question is that the intent to include such exploration in on the on this type of credit? I think, in general, the comparison chart you saw in other areas of the world, these are areas where you're drilling wells far apart in frontier areas. I think credits in areas where you're drilling extension exploration wells or closer in may look different. So truly, I think, you know, you're sort of looking at different issues, and you're looking at a compendium of risk and a compendium of cost associated with those risks. And it's very hard to quantify that exploration risk in a totally simplistic way. The 3 mile standard was used to be that simpler, easier to use standard, and it certainly does cut out looking at deeper horizons in the existing, near existing known accumulations.
It would be, Senator Taylor well pointed out, this is significant legislation. So when we finish discussion tonight, we're going to hold the bill, bring it back tomorrow morning. And I know there's some technical amendments to be done, so we'll bring back a CS that fixes up some things. So if some of this discussion leads to changes that you want to do, we'll have that opportunity to talk about that tomorrow, but the intent would be tomorrow to pass this out. Is there any discussion?
Other subject, and it's more general or generic than anything. As the pool of participants and producers has diminished from the seven original sisters down, I can't help but, and maybe it's just my jaded old nature, I don't know. I just can't help but wonder to what extent we're being manipulated in the process as an owner state. To what extent are decisions being made in boardrooms in London or someplace else that say, no, we're not going to drill any more wells up there for a while. We're not going to really aggressively go after production there. Instead, let's pour our money into someplace else where we can then leverage that country, leverage that development as against those folks sitting in Alaska. And the more we down-tune this thing and down-tune the screws, especially with them running into a deficit situation on existing production, but now we've got a further opportunity for creative legislation that will provide us with additional incentives. I mean, I have to believe if I was sitting on the board of directors of that company and making those kinds of decisions, I would certainly be playing you off against everybody I could find to play you off, and then I'd find some way of getting in here at the end of the session, and I'd dump something on this group and say, okay, kids, you want any more wells? This is what you got to do. Or else. And I'm concerned about that. I want to know if you share any of that concern, and if in fact you feel that we are being manipulated to some extent.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps I might answer that.
Mr. Tuck into that microphone right there, if you would, please. Thank you.
Senator Taylor, first of all, the governor, when several different speeches, he has mentioned exploration credits, and although I have not been present with the governor during all the discussions on this issue, I believe that we were not being manipulated by the oil companies. This was came up within the administration. We certainly were influenced by the information that was handed out to you about the exploration credits that we offer, that Alaska offers compared to the rest of the world. I guess that's short and simple.
Thank you. Steve, Mr. Porter?
Yeah, Senator Taylor, through the chair. There's two points. One is this was not at the industry's initiative, it was at the government's initiative. The industry had no idea it was coming. So just to assure you of that. The other one is that there is an incentive that's occurring here, and it's actually an incentive that you have to think about for a second. The right now the oil industry has a substantial amount of production up here, but they take that value and they can either reinvest it in the state of Alaska, or they can invest it someplace else. And then truly the boardroom plays. I mean, the question is, do you all prospects are being equal, because we have to assume that at the present time. Do you spend, 20% or 30 cents on the dollar? Do you spend 65 cents on the dollar? And by and large, if you look at for example, BP's annual report, where did they go? They went to, I think three of these are on here. Azerbaijan, the 5 cents on the dollar is one of their top priorities. Trinidad and Tobago, I think, is another one that's on the priority. So they will, in fact, do that. They will play us, but they're going to play us not necessarily in the way you stated it. They're going to take their revenue and drill where the most prospective, where they get the most bang for their buck. And what this legislation is intending to do is to draw some of that dollars back to the state.
Thank you. Mr. Porter, before we, you're new here, just a new face about a month ago. Why don't you just take 1 minute and introduce yourself, because I think we're going to see a lot of you over the next 4 to 8 years. Maybe your credentials just for a second.
Historically, I've spent 21 years in the oil and gas industry. I was in the land department for ARCO for a number of years, was the exploration permitting manager for ARCO, went through the ConocoPhillips regime. My most recent job was community and native relations manager for the company, negotiating a lot of the issues on the North Slope. So I have some level of background experience in with
thank you. Mr. Myers?
Senator Taylor, maybe I could take another shot at a couple of the issues.
Let's do a brief shot at it.
Okay. One of the things the bill does on seismic data is it requires the release of the data after 10 years. So again, that's going to be a value to all parties. So on the seismic, I think there's a clear value that we don't have now that helps everyone across the board, particularly companies that don't have a large database of seismic on the North Slope or another Cook Inlet for that matter. The second thing is I do think the credit applies equally to independents as well as producers, although independents would have to sell the credit and get, you know, a little less than 100% of the value. So it's a broad across the board. It certainly doesn't solve all the